Good morning. We thank you for tuning into our radio program today. This program is brought to you each Sunday morning by the Parkway Church of Christ here in Bowling Green. Let me take just a few minutes here to remind you of who we are and where we are, what our purpose is. I've not done that in a couple of weeks. We assemble each Sunday morning at 9 o'clock for Bible classes at the building located at 125 Hilltopper Avenue here in Bowling Green. Those of you who are listening on the internet might wonder where we are. Bowling Green, Kentucky. And that's, again, 125 Hilltopper Avenue. We would love to have you come and visit with us if that's possible for you. 9 o'clock for Bible classes. Together, then, we meet together in the auditorium at 10 o'clock on Sunday mornings. Also, again, we meet, reconvene at 6 o'clock on Sunday evenings for worship services. 10 o'clock Sunday morning, 6 o'clock Sunday evening for worship services. We also have Bible study classes at 7 o'clock on Wednesday evenings. We do encourage you to come and meet with us and bring your Bible, bring family members. If you have children, bring your spouse, your children, and maybe you're a grandparent. You can bring your grandchildren. And let them approach the Bible directly. This is our way at Parkway. We believe the Scriptures to be the exclusive guide of faith and practice. By that we mean no human creeds, no opinionism, no speculation. We are interested in what the Bible actually says. And we believe this can be known because of what Paul tells us. The Apostle Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 3 in verse 4 when he said, whereby the concerning the things that had been delivered to him, he said, when you read, you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ. We are instructed. Jesus repeatedly said, listen and understand. Mark 12:37 says, the common people heard Christ gladly. So you don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to be highly educated in order to understand the Scriptures. It just takes the proper attitude. And we must constantly examine ourselves and make sure that our attitude towards Bible study is proper. Make sure that we're open-minded, objective. Make sure that we're approaching the Scriptures from the perspective of wanting to know what they mean rather than wanting to find what we need in order to prove what we already think. That is a dangerous approach to Bible study. I suppose there are a number of areas in life where people do this. And there are a number of different standards. You think of different legal findings and rulings, and lawyers go through things really looking for something that will confirm what they want to prove. This is just the way the court system is conducted. And you may have two opposing positions, but both are looking for precedent, they're looking for previous rulings that will benefit their case. And then, of course, a judge and or a jury will need to evaluate that and see which one is properly using his citations. Well, when it comes to the Bible, it becomes very, very serious because we're trying to determine what is the will of God. So we want to approach the Bible with a very humble and a mind and a very open mind. And then we want to search the Scriptures to see what is so, as Acts 17:11 talks about. I want this morning, due to the timing of the program here right before a couple of days before a major elections, but includes the election of the President of the United States. So this is a very important election. Everyone is saying that. I keep hearing both liberals and progressives and conservatives say this is the most important election in a generation. Of course, I'm old, so I've heard that many times before. But possibly, I was thinking about this the other day when I kept hearing this from both sides. Both sides. Kamala Harris says it, Donald Trump says it, and everyone in between says it. So I was thinking about it, and I thought, is it possible that because of the changes on standards, different people taking radically different views, that it could be said, and is this is increasingly the way of things, and the divide between the left and the right tends to get larger and larger, why the gap is wider and wider, that is it possible that if we could be right, people could be right in saying that each successive time that this is the most important election in a generation? I could see how that could actually be true. And when you think about, and by the way, friends, some of you may be thinking, I don't know why Tim's talking about voting. He's supposed to be a Bible teacher and preacher. Oh, we will be looking at the verses on this just here directly. This is in the way of introduction. I want you to think, though, generally about what we have the ability to do with a vote. When you have political positions that include positions that are matters of morals and ethics, I was just texting someone about how it is so glibly, so easily, so shamelessly is the word that I used in a text to someone, so shamelessly lie. It is rather remarkable. And then very many times you have very few people who call attention to these lies. Now, what about that? How can a society function when you have its leaders who are just willing to absolutely lie about what things are happening? So what if you had a party that was devoted basically to its moral standard was do whatever you have to do in order to keep your power. And so that would include any number of things. You could just absolutely lie about your position on things. You know, history shows one thing, but then you're in an election, so you say things that you need to say in order to win certain demographics. So that happens. What about lying? Is lying a biblical subject? Lying is so much a biblical subject that the first sin that we read about in the New Testament church, that was committed by two people, a husband and wife, in Acts chapter 5, Ananias and Sapphira, was lying. That's the first sin. The first sin was lying that we know of, that we read about, and it was so serious that God executed miraculously interposed himself and executed the people who were the liars. They were unrepentant, by the way. They just bold-facedly lied about what they had done, and God just killed them. They just fell down dead. Of course, that was the miracle age. We don't see that happening today. We're not in the miracle age. So God doesn't deal with people that way today. He is deferring judgment today. Lying is still sinful. Now, I say that because then you go all the way to the other end of the spectrum in Revelation chapter 21 in verse 8, and what does it say there? What sin is included with sexual immorality and other things that are obviously wrong, murder? Well, lying. All liars will find their part in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. So, friends, telling the truth is a requirement. Lying is sinful, and it is a biblical matter. What about abortion? What if you have a political party, and their really primary motivator is women being able to kill their babies? The most important thing in their political platform is that women be able to kill their babies. What about that? Does that have anything to do with the Bible? Murder is at the heart of evil in the Bible. If you start reading in the Bible, you're going to read about murder very early on in Genesis chapter 4, where Cain rose up and slew his brother Abel. You can read about that in the first several verses of Genesis chapter 4. Because Cain was jealous of his brother. He was jealous of Abel's approval by God, before God. And so he slew him, it says. And then you just keep reading about it. And laws were given. In fact, very quickly in Genesis chapter 9. Not long. You don't have to read very many chapters after Genesis 4 to read that God made a law about that. And he said that whoever sheds man's blood, verse 6, Genesis 9, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. Killing an innocent life. Killing an innocent life. The deliberate, premeditated killing, taking of an innocent life, is murder. And the Bible always condemns it. It condemned it under the patriarchal system, Genesis 9:6. It condemned it under the Mosaic system, Exodus chapter 21 and verse 13. And it condemns it in the New Testament, where we see in Romans chapter 13 in verses 3 and 4. That murder, that God allows execution of those who do what is evil. What about one who is a murderer? Is he doing what is evil? Is he harming his neighbor? The rest of that chapter, if you read on, so I'll talk specifically about that. Paul said, if I've committed an offense or done anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. Acts 25 and verse 11. So we want to appreciate the fact that murder is always condemned in the Scripture. Murder is the taking, the premeditated taking of innocent life. And we need to appreciate that abortion falls well within that definition. So what if you have a political party that believes that lying is okay as long as it promotes the party? You know, the old Marxist, Stalinist view of lying. Maoist view of it. Or what a party that believes that it's okay for mothers just to kill their babies, their unborn babies. What about that? That would be a biblical matter. What about a political party that supports the funding of what's called transgender transitioning, including drugs and hormones that destroy little children's lives? What about that? What does the Bible say about that, males and females? Well, that God made them male and female. God made them male and female. We need to appreciate what the Bible teaches on that. This whole transgenderism thing is a big lie. And it is absolutely destroying. I'm sure many of you in this audience have seen many of the videos of the detransitioners trying to get their lives back when they realized that they were made terrible decisions and were quickly facilitated in destroying their bodies by so-called medical professionals. It's really sad. Someone needs to be punished for this stuff. This needs to stop. So what if you have a political party that's all about that and supports that? Well, that gets into the realm of the moral. And I wanted to talk about some things that relate to this. Because with a vote, we have the ability to choose a better direction. Now, with the vote, will you always choose the perfect? Do you always have the ability to choose the perfect? No, you often have the choice, only the choice to choose the better. To choose the better of the two. But we always look for a direction, look for direction in things that we do. Is a thing generally going in a good direction, or is it generally going in a bad direction? When you think of a policy, is it taking us in a... Let's ask the question, where is that taking us? Where does it go, you might ask? Where does it go? Does it go in a good direction, or does it go in a bad direction? So often that's what we're doing, and we don't want to sacrifice the good in search of the perfect when it comes to politics. Obviously, that's true. You just don't see many high-moral people in politics. You're looking for better, maybe not necessarily the perfect. It's going to be hard to find the perfect. And so we have to think in that way and train ourselves to think in that way. and there are a number of issues we could talk about, but I'm looking at the clock here. I want to answer some objections. I read the other day that there's somewhere between 20 and 30 million people who call themselves Christians who will not vote. And that's fascinating to me, but I think I know why it is that a lot of people who call themselves Christians do not vote. They have been taught religious error. It's amazing how overlapping this can be with the civic realm, civil policies, and what we call politics. It's amazing how overlapping religious error is with that. And I want to talk about that a little bit. I have known, I've talked to many people who do not believe it is that it's in their best interest to take any time at all to vote, because they say God is in control of that. I've heard this from people all of my life, and I hear it from people who call themselves Christians. And I want to talk about this. And some of you may be thinking, did you talk a little bit about this back a few weeks ago? And I did. But we have the election coming up, and I want to be a little more specific. I'll be using some passages that we did not look at then. And I want us to think about this idea of God being in control. Now, if you believe that God is in some kind of, not just control, we all believe, if we believe the Bible, we believe God is in ultimate control of everything. The question is, how does He do it? We all believe that God is, if you believe the Bible, you believe that God is in control. I do. But the question is, how is God in control? And I want to throw out some passages, and I want you to think about these things. The question is, how is God in control? Does He work His will through humans, or does He do it regardless of what humans say or do? Regardless of how we act. Which one is it? In other words, God could miraculously appoint leaders. You know, if you go back into the Old Testament, and I don't think many people really believe we're under the Jewish theocracy today of the Old Testament. Some people will go to the Old Testament for authority for specific religious things, like, for example, the use of instruments of music in worship or the practice of tithing. You're going to have to go to the Old Testament. You can't go to the New Testament, for example, on that or on those things, because, for example, on tithing, the New Testament passage teaches that we are to give as we have prospered. Now, that may end up being 10% for you. That may end up being, if you're on fixed income and inflation is horrible, that may have ended up being less than 10%. God doesn't judge that. He just judges that we give as we have prospered. It may be that it's more than 10%. It may be way more than 10% if you're making millions of dollars a year. And so that's why you have those instructions in 1 Corinthians 16 in verses 1 and 2. Defining how we, the principle upon which we give. We're not under the 10% tithing law today because we're not under the Old Testament. We're not under the law of Moses, we're under the law of Christ. And the same is true with instrumental music. We do not worship God that way today. The New Testament never authorizes the use of instruments of music in worship to God. It only authorizes the use of the human voice, speaking to yourselves in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. So how does this work? Well, what's the problem? They go back and they read verses like Daniel chapter 4 and verse 25. When it comes to this question of how does God work in relation to government. And I'll tell you, some people, they know only that verse. I know people now. They will cite that verse to you. Daniel 4:25. The lesson that Nebuchadnezzar was to learn about God's rule in the kingdoms of men. And Nebuchadnezzar, the hard way, did learn that lesson if you read the rest of that chapter. What about this idea of God ruling in the kingdoms of men? How does that work? How did it work then? You know, God actually set up rulers. God actually spoke to leaders, communicated His will to civil leaders, put it into their hearts some way. In some of these passages, we're not told how He did it. But He put into their minds somehow. He put into their minds what He wanted them to do. Is God working that way today? Are we under a theocratic system of government and of life? We are not. We are not. Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. It is a spiritual kingdom." John 18:36. "Kingdom of God is within you." Luke 17:20-21. We're not under that system, friends. The kingdom is the church. The terms church and kingdom are used interchangeably in Matthew 16:18-19. So, and let me just spend just a couple more minutes on that. If you go back to the Old Testament, you're going to see things like this. You're going to see things like in Isaiah chapter 44 and the last verse of that chapter. Isaiah chapter 44, and let me get you, in case you're taking notes, I believe that's verse 28 if I remember. Yes, verse 28, who says of Cyrus, Isaiah says, here's what God says of Cyrus, "He is my shepherd." Cyrus the Persian, "He is my shepherd, and he shall perform all my pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, you shall be rebuilt." Now, they were in Babylonian captivity. They were in Babylonian captivity, but the Persians would be God's instrument to punish the Babylonians and to allow, as we see later with Artaxerxes, the decree to let them go back and rebuild the city walls of Jerusalem and the Jewish temple. "He will perform all my pleasure." I'm reading from Isaiah 44:28. And verse 41 of chapter 45, "Thus says the Lord to his anointed." Who's that? Well, this is not talking about Christ this time. Sometimes the anointed is Christ. Sometimes the anointed would be a high priest or a king or a prophet. This time it's none of those. He's speaking of Cyrus the Persian. And says of Cyrus, "whose right hand I have held, to subdue nations before him, and loose the armor of kings, to open before him the double door, so that the gates will not be shut." Later, Cyrus will be referred to in chapter 46 and verse 11 of Isaiah as God's bird of prey that he calls from the east. God's bird of prey. What was he doing? The same thing with him that he did with the Assyrians back in Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 5 when he said Assyria, he says of Assyria, "he is a rod in my hand." So God has done that before. But how is he working today? This is what we need to ask ourselves. Don't go to these, if you're going to go to these Old Testament passages, you're going to also be obligated to the things that are talked about in those passages. What are you going to do? Go back and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the Jerusalem city walls? Are you going to go back and rebuild the Jewish temple? Because that's what this is talking about. Now, why would you rebuild the Jewish temple? Are you going to also offer the animal sacrifices, daily sacrifices that were offered in conjunction with the worship service that was done in the Jewish temple? No. No, people are not doing that. They don't want any of that. Are you going to follow the cleanliness laws? Are you going to respect the travel limitations on a Saturday, on the Sabbath? No. No one's doing that. It's funny what they do. They just pick and choose which parts of this they want. So when it comes to politics, they want to be able to stay out of things and not vote or feel like they need to. And so they say God is in control. And they cite these passages like the ones I've mentioned that have a certain context of time and of dispensation, which is a word the Bible uses to describe a form of governance. Now, that could be the Mosaical system, that could be the patriarchal system, or that could be the Christian system. The system of Christ, to be more exact in my terminology. So friends, we need to be very careful about this. And going back to Daniel 4:25 or Isaiah chapter 44 and verse 28 or 45:1 or Isaiah 46:11, the bird of prey, or Isaiah 10:5, the rod of the Assyrian government. Be careful about that, because God's not doing that today. So this begs a question, well then what is your point? What is your point? Well, the New Testament is so clear in answering this. How does God work today? For example, on this question of voting. Some preachers will stand in pulpits and say, oh, it doesn't do any good to vote, God's in control. Well, now that is probably one of the most ignorant things I've ever heard a preacher say. What does he mean it does no good to vote? Does he mean that God disallows the votes of Christians? Does that mean your vote is not going to count alongside of the one or before that was before you or the one that was after yours? Maybe that were votes that were cast by atheists who believe in abortion, who want to spend your money, who want to spend your tax money on paying for it, who want to spend your tax money on transitioning surgeries, hormone procedures that don't turn a boy into a girl, but they destroy their bodies and mess up their minds. That's all they do. They don't change their DNA. They don't change their chromosomes. So anyway, but do you want to be paying for that? Because that's how they may have voted. Now look at Philippians chapter 2 and verse 13. Paul says, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. It is God who works in you. Now, if you were to look at all the verses around that, because that's how you determine whether or not you understand a passage correctly. For example, if we were to look at the verses right after this, Paul goes on and says, do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without fault, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. Some of you may be thinking, that sounds familiar. That now sounds familiar. Maybe you have not heard this verse that talks about God working in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure, but maybe you've heard about this idea of being a light in the world. That would be because people use the Beatitude passage in Matthew chapter 5 to make this point, and that's great. I'm glad they do. But are they listening to what they're saying? Jesus said, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled under foot of men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. You may be thinking of this verse, it's so good. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. What did they see in order to make them turn to a consideration of God? What did they see that might lead to them actually glorifying God? Did you read that? Did you pay attention to that? This says that they may see your good works, your good behavior, your good actions. Actions that derive from whom? From what? From God, from his instructions. So you see, friends, you and I, if we were to implement God's will in our lives, we are setting before others what God does in those regards, in those areas. That's how God works through us. We need to remember that. Our time is up this morning, so is it important for us to vote? The answer to that is absolutely. Our votes may reflect a moral stance on a number of different things. Vote might be against abortion, you see. the vote might be against many things that government does that are wrong and for things that are done right. So we ought to think about this a little bit more. Appreciate your time today. We hope you'll tune in for our study next week. Until then, we bid you a pleasant good day.